Good morning, it's 9:30. The Green Valley News here at Sun Sounds of Arizona for Monday, August 17th. A Green Valley couple escaped injury but lost their dog, their home, and two vehicles in a fire that happened on Sunday. Santa Rita Fire District Deputy Chief Greg Van Alstein said that the couple in the 1100 block of North Placita Yellows were awakened by fire alarms shortly before 2:30 in the morning and then called 911. When they awoke, they found smoke in the house. They went to the door that was connected to their garage, and when they opened it, they saw flames. They then went inside and closed it and exited through the front door, where they found their garage and most of the front side of their house on fire. Firefighters saw 20-foot flames coming through the roof of the couple's garage as they raced to the scene down La Cañada, Van Alstein said. When crews arrived, they found half of the home engulfed in flames and decided to fight the fire from the outside alone, according to Van Alstein. Once we found out there was a dog and we were able to get the fire to one side, a team went in very rapidly to do a rapid search for the dog, which is pretty risky in our business because once we call it a defensive fire, we really don't go in, he said. But we thought he might be in the back bedroom with the door that was closed. The doors were open. Firefighters worked for 28 minutes to revive the dog, but it succumbed to the heat and the smoke inhalation. It took 43 minutes to bring the fire under control. Crews were on the scene until about 9 o'clock in the morning, Van Alstein said. In all, 27 firefighters from SRFD and Drexel Heights worked the blaze. The house and the vehicles parked in the driveway were total losses. The cause of the fire is under investigation, and the couple is staying with neighbors for now, he said. Two people were sent to a hospital on Saturday after a golf cart overturned onto a steep embankment, leading to a tricky rescue effort for the Santa Rita Fire District. Two people were in golf carts when it rolled at Camino del Portillo and Camino del Desierto, heading down a rocky slope near a culvert. One person managed to get out, but the other was trapped under the cart on the side of the arroyo, prompting a prolonged and complicated extrication. Due to the instability of the vehicle and the location where the patient was pinned underneath on jagged rocks, crews had to stabilize and lift the vehicle off the patient while ensuring that the vehicle didn't move or slide, injuring the patient even more. The patients with minor injuries were evaluated and taken to a hospital. The Pima County Sheriff's Department is investigating the accident. Miranda Lopez caught the Democratic Socialist wave in Arizona, or better yet, she brought it here. Lopez, who's 31 years old, is set to become the first Arizona state legislator to self-identify as a Democratic Socialist. Lopez nearly defeated incumbent Democrat Stephanie Dahl Hamilton in the July 21st primary in LD21, which includes parts of Santa Cruz, Pima, and Cochise counties. LD21 voter registration leans heavily Democratic, and Lopez, another primary winner, incumbent Representative Consuelo Hernandez, are expected to win easily in November. I think we're starting to see a movement toward actually wanting to address a lot of these problems through a social lens rather than through the capitalistic lens that we've been raised with, Lopez said in an interview. Her win on a shoestring budget comes in a decade of nationwide wins for the Democratic Socialists of America. During Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign, party membership rose from about 6,000 in 2015 to 120,000 now. The organization has chapters in every state. The midterms are looking strong for the DSA on the national level. As of August 21st, 61 DSA-endorsed candidates have won two primaries. In Michigan's closely watched U.S. Senate Democratic primary, Abdul Al-Sayed edged out moderate Haley Stevens on August 4th. Al-Sayed is not endorsed by the DSA and said he is not technically or practically associated with the group, but Democratic Socialist lawmakers such as Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York have campaigned for him. It's awesome, Lopez said of Al-Sayed's win. I'm just excited to see a lot more Democrat socialists winning around the country. Lopez edged toward Democratic Socialism while an undergrad at the University of Arizona studying Spanish. She served as a field organizer for the statewide Democratic Coordinating Committee and later as a master's student in public administration, was director of the Pima County Democratic Party, and joined the United Campus Workers Union. Sometime in this period, she grew cynical of the Democrats. "Democrats and Republicans are essentially the same thing," she told the Nogales International. "It's just different labels for the same entities that are being funded through the same billionaires and corporations." And when it came to time to announce her candidacy, the DSA offered its support, she said. She said Lopez declined PAC and corporate donations during her first run for public office. She also embraced a traditional socialist platform, calling for the reallocation and redistribution of wealth. For her, the democratic socialist philosophy offers more radical solutions to schools, housing, and the environment. Like other DSA candidates, Lopez advocates for getting rid of the so-called voucher system for schools that she said exists only because of the systematic defunding of public schools. She supports a more straightforward grant process through the Arizona Department of Housing and wants the state to stop incentivizing data centers and mining projects. Hernandez, poised to win her third term in the state house, embraces a traditional centrist platform, frequently crossing the aisle to work alongside her Republican colleagues. She teamed up with Maritza Higuera during the campaign. Higuera finished fourth among four candidates. Lopez takes particular issue with legislation that Hernandez backed to punish businesses for boycotting Israel. "Boycotting is one of the oldest powers that the people of the United States have," Lopez said. "If you can't freely voice your thoughts and opinions, you're not really free." She also went after Hernandez during a clean elections debate, saying her opponent spent 4 years accepting money from the utility companies raising our bills and developers pricing out our renters. Lopez said Hernandez's vote with the Republicans last year to ban encampments at state universities was one reason she jumped into the race. "Hernandez basically lost my vote, and I decided that I wanted to see somebody who was very progressive, very young, running for this office to really represent the best that the district has to offer," Lopez said during the debate. "And I thought that person should probably be me." Lopez also calls for the abolition of ICE, posting to her campaign site, "Expletive ICE, defund ICE." She calls immigration and customs enforcement a tool for the federal government in order to bully immigrants, the people who really want to make this country great, and she hopes the system can be reconfigured so that it is less punishing. Lopez also said in an interview that Nogales has been overlooked. "Nogales has definitely not been getting the investment from the state that they need and that they deserve," she said. "That's something that I definitely want to fight for." Larry Bootsma was 23 years old when he experienced psychosis for the first time. His parents still remember the phone call from his apartment. He was panicking, saying bugs were crawling out of the vents. He was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. Larry exhausted every level of Arizona's behavioral health system over the next 25 years, including its most intensive public services for people with serious mental illness, or SMI. He was ordered by a judge to receive treatment, assigned to work with a specialized team of psychiatrists, nurses, and case managers, and eventually given a court-appointed public guardian. Despite those interventions, Larry never found lasting stability. He lived on the streets and cycled in and out of hospitals and treatment centers, occasionally landing in jail as his illness worsened. And then, on the morning of September 24th of 2025, the 47-year-old, known to his family as Larry Bear, was found dead at a bus stop in Phoenix, just outside of the mental health clinic where he received treatment. The medical examiner said he died of a drug overdose. "All of this didn't have to end like this. That's the hardest part for me," said Helen Bootsma, Larry's mom. "He could have gotten better." The cycle of failed treatment that preceded Larry's death reflects a gap that Arizona has recognized for years. The state has no appropriate treatment options for people with mental illnesses that are too severe to be managed in the community but don't qualify for long-term hospitalization. Advocates estimate that up to 3% of the roughly 63,000 Arizonans with serious mental illness, that's nearly 2,000 people, could fall into that gap. Lawmakers tried to address the problem in 2019 when they authorized secure behavior health residential facilities, small group homes where patients could receive longer-term court-ordered treatment in a secure setting. AZCIR found that 7 years that followed, the effort repeatedly faltered amid contractor failures, funding gaps, legal complications, and provider challenges. It wasn't until of April of 2026 that the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or ACCESS, the state's Medicaid agency, began seeking providers to operate the long-promised facilities. Even then, it couldn't say when they'd be up and running. In the meantime, some of Arizona's sickest psychiatric patients are left rotating through costly, short-term interventions that experts say repeatedly fail to produce meaningful recovery. 2 days before Larry died, Helen received a message from his treatment team at Taros Health. Larry had picked up his medications and was compliant with his court order. By the state's own standards, the system was doing what it was designed to do. But the team also mentioned that Larry was mixing methamphetamine with fentanyl and following it with alcohol. His daily use had increased substantially since his detox just a week earlier. The message ended with an explanation that his parents had gotten countless times before. Taros' policy is to meet the client where they are. We will continue to encourage Larry to seek assistance for his substance use when and if he is ready. Of course, substance use is never a reason to psychiatrically hospitalize anybody, so Larry's increased use is not a legitimate reason to amend his court-ordered treatment. His treatment team could encourage care, monitor his condition, and respond when he was in crisis. But unless his illness put him in immediate danger or left him unable to care for himself, they had few options to keep him in treatment. Most of Arizona's behavior health system is built around this kind of voluntary model, and a lot of the time it works. But Larry, like many people with the most severe forms of SMI, had anosognosia, a neurological condition that left him unable to recognize that he was ill. It is a primary reason people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder refuse medication, walk out of treatment, and experience repeated relapses. 1 in 4 adults with serious mental illness also has substance use disorder, which can worsen the symptoms of mental illness and make long-term recovery that much harder. For people who can't voluntarily engage in treatment, a few days or weeks of care is rarely enough to stabilize them, said Josh Mozell. He's a mental health attorney and president for the Association of the Chronically Mentally Ill. They cycle through things like group homes and homelessness and crisis centers and interactions with police and fire, Mozell said, all the while getting sicker and sicker and sicker and almost irredeemable. That cycle defined Larry's adult life. In the 5 years before he died, Larry was hospitalized at least 26 times for a total of 280 days, according to a timeline compiled by his parents. Between hospitalizations, he was placed in behavior health residential facilities at least 10 times. The group homes provide round-the-clock care, but patients can leave whenever they want. Each of Larry's stays was followed by another crisis and another hospitalization. What a waste for him to be admitted in each one of those situations and then not have a positive outcome, said Helen, who is an advocate with Arizona Mad Moms, an organization that supports families of people with serious mental illness. Each one of these would have been, could have been, an opportunity for wellness. According to an ACCESS report, nearly half of the roughly 8,000 people with serious mental illness discharged from unlocked residential facilities in fiscal year 2025 were hospitalized within a year. In the same report to the governor, the agency acknowledged that conditions such as anosognosia means that some people are unable to engage voluntarily in interventions. including antipsychotic medication and community support, and that court-ordered treatment may be necessary for stabilization. That's why lawmakers authorized secure residential treatment 7 years ago. Unlike traditional residential facilities, patients couldn't simply walk out, giving them time to stabilize on medication, gain insight into their illness, and ideally transition to a less restrictive setting. The homes, which capped at 16 beds, are meant for individuals under court-ordered treatment whose repeated hospitalizations, homelessness, or arrest show that they have been unsuccessful in less restrictive settings. Judges could authorize placements ranging from 3 to 12 months. Under those criteria, Larry would have qualified for placement, and his parents believe it could have made all of the difference. In a secure environment and taking his meds, Helen said, Larry was a different boy. His parents saw that version of him one last time in the week before he died. During his final hospital stay at Aurora Behavioral Health, he was on clozapine, an antipsychotic medication primarily used for treatment-resistant schizophrenia. Larry was like his old self, they said, cracking jokes and discussing football, Carl's Jr., and music. We talked about things that a normal couple of guys would talk about, his dad, Elvern, said. A week later, he was gone. Public records and interviews show Arizona's effort to build secure facilities stalled after a series of setbacks. Access awarded grant funding to a provider in 2020, but the project ran into delays finding properties, rising construction costs, and budget constraints. After the provider failed to meet the terms of its agreement, Access halted the project and ended the contract in 2022. Lawmakers approved $25 million for the construction of 5 secure facilities that same year, but the funding was pulled from the state budget after Access was unable to move the project forward. Attempts to restore that funding failed 2 years in a row. Instead, lawmakers approved a $5 million appropriation in 2025 for Access to restart the effort. We thought we could pass the law and the agencies would get the rest done, Moselle said. That's just not the truth. If you're going to get something done that actually builds a level of care in this system, you need to hold these agencies' hands. The project hit another roadblock after county attorneys identified a pathway in the law that allowed people charged with a dangerous crime and found mentally unfit to stand trial to be placed in secure facilities alongside civil psychiatric patients. Moselle said providers were unwilling to participate until lawmakers passed a measure separating the two populations in 2025, a fix that cost the project another year. Disability rights and civil liberties organizations also have raised concerns that expanding secure or involuntary treatment could come at an expense of patients' rights and due process. People with disabilities have the right to receive services in the least restrictive setting that's appropriate for their needs, said Asim Dietrich, a supervisory attorney at Disability Rights Arizona. Citing shortages of community treatment teams and overburdened case managers, he contended that if more resources were focused on home and community-based services, we likely wouldn't need those secure facilities. Supporters of secure treatment say the due process concerns, while valid, mischaracterize how the facilities would actually work. By the time somebody qualifies for the placement, a judge has already determined that less restrictive options have failed and the legal standard for involuntary care has been met. More than any place in the behavioral health system, there's going to be due process, Moselle said during a 2000 legislative hearing as lawmakers considered creating the facilities. Leslie Carpenter of the National Treatment Advocacy Center, which has long advocated for expanding involuntary treatment options for people that do have severe mental illness, thinks that the debate has become too polarized. Both sides agree that community-based services need strengthening, she said, but for the sickest patients, secure treatment fills a gap that community care alone cannot close. A secure setting does not automatically have to be a bad setting, said Carpenter, the senior legislative advocacy manager. I would propose that the number of people that we're seeing in our prisons, in our jails, homeless and untreated, and in our graveyards, that's much more carceral than to be in a state facility and meant to meet their needs. Without secure residential facilities available, many of Arizona's sickest mental patients are trapped in a loop of emergency room visits, psychiatric hospitalizations, and crisis care, a pattern that comes at a steep cost to the state. Last year alone, Access spent more than $1.2 billion on behavioral health services for members that have serious mental illness, about $20,000 per member on average. A 2024 paper authored by Moselle and other mental health experts said that those who would qualify for secure treatment visit emergency rooms 5 times more than the general population and, when hospitalized, stay 4 times as long. They said it would be less costly, more therapeutic, and more humane for the person to spend this time in a secure, home-like setting. Experts say secure residential facilities could also help relieve a long-standing bottleneck at the Arizona State Hospital, the state's highest level of long-term psychiatric treatment. These people at that highest, most secure level of treatment that are ready for discharge if there is a place to put them, said Will Humble, the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Patients at the Arizona State Hospital stay an average of more than 4 years. In just the first month of the current fiscal year, discharge delays kept beds occupied for a combined 482 days by patients who no longer needed to be there. Those delays are especially significant in Arizona, which had the lowest rate of state-operated psychiatric beds for civilly committed patients in the nation as of 2023. In April, 7 years after the Arizona authorized secure behavioral health facilities for people with serious mental illness, Access formally began its search for providers to build and operate them. But the agency still could not say when facilities would open. Access told AZCRR that the providers have to be selected and facilities must be developed, licensed, and staffed before those services can begin. The progress came too late for Larry. He died before Arizona established the kind of care his family believes could have helped him. His parents hold on to the memory of the son they knew, affectionate, fiercely competitive, and always reaching for a guitar, their Larry Bear. On June 26th, what would have been Larry's 48th birthday, Helen brushed aside blades of grass from his headstone before laying a single red rose across the top. She rested her hand there for a moment, then reached up to take her husband's. "He's safe now," Elvern told her. "He's okay." FIFA, made its final payment to Pima County on Thursday for booking County Fields as a training site during the World Cup, but the final contract amount came up short after the Iran War threw a last-minute curveball. Iran's national team had planned to use Keno Sports Complex as its home base from June 6th through the 27th as it competed in its first-round World Cup games along the West Coast. But the U.S. and Israel launched airstrikes on February 28th that killed Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, leading the war. The war led to the Iranian team pulling out of Tucson as a training site and relocating to fields in Tijuana, Mexico. Keno Sports Complex Director Sarah Hanna confirmed for the Green Valley News Sun on April 10th that FIFA had paid 50% of the $213,952 contract, wiring $106,976 to county coffers for the 22-day use period that started on June 6th. Iran requested FIFA move its games out of the United States in April but was denied, leaving the county to continue making preparations for the team's arrival. FIFA confirmed reports on May 25th that Iran had moved its training camp to Tijuana. Iran bypassing Keno was the second recent international team planned for Keno that fell through due to federal actions. A Mexican League baseball team from Navajoa planned to set up shop at Keno as Tucson's professional team, but visa issues prevented players from ever digging their cleats into the field. Pima County spokesman Mark Evans told the Green Valley News Sun on Friday that FIFA paid $12,929 on Thursday, marking its final payment and cashing out at $119,905. He said FIFA had also donated $40,470 in equipment to the complex that included goals, nets, and turf-related gear. Evans said the country's FIFA preparation expenses for the site totaled $119,905, and the $40,470 of in-kind donations put the county at $160,375. The total is $94,047 short of the contract's total revenue, excluding the $40,470 in-kind donation. Evans said the contract amount was for usage and FIFA didn't pay for what they didn't use, but did reimburse for the county's costs getting the site ready for Iran. Hunter didn't see the lost World Cup revenue as putting the county in the hole. "We were able to shift requests to alternate facilities for almost all of them," she said. For example, normal soccer field use was booked on the South Complex instead of the North Complex, a smaller high school graduation that used the North Stadium last year. We shifted them indoors to our event center and still held the event. Keno moved FC Tucson to another field to accommodate Iran using the team's primary stadium. The county set up a grandstand with additional seating to allow 1,500 to 2,000 fans to meet the FC Tucson's every attendance at the main stadium. Hanna said FC Tucson played games at the grandstand during the preparation period. As soon as FIFA canceled, they moved back into the North Stadium and played the majority of their season where they normally would, she said. The county had to turn away a handful of inquiries for lack of space, but Hanna said having to decline events due to space is typical for Keno. "Usually the events just push back their event date to fit in when we have availability," she said. "Or plenty of inquiries at the end of the inquiry stage and are just people feeling out various event spaces." The county also anticipated heavy security while Iran's team trained at Keno. Hanna told the Green Valley News Sun in April that the county was in contact with the Pima County Sheriff, Tucson Police, and Oro Valley Police Departments, as well as the Arizona Department of Public Safety and federal agencies to develop a security plan. She said the plans were likely to focus on general safety and keeping curious observers and fans at bay. Hanna said the county's expenses with security would have negated any additional revenue Keno would have taken in from FIFA. "The timing of this helped too," Hanna said, "with the usage period. This event occurred when it was hot, so we weren't as busy on that complex at the time. We didn't have an influx of requests for use." Green Valley News for Monday. Mark DeGruft wishing you a wonderful rest of your day. Back on Wednesday. Till then, stay cool and take care.